This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Is it time to talk about society crashing when the climate shifts? In December, over 250 scientists and other experts published a letter in the Guardian newspaper in the UK. The title is A Warning on Climate and the Risk of Societal Collapse. Will Steffen is one of the leading authors. Steffen is Emeritus Professor at the Australian National University. He directed major international projects, including the International Geosphere Biosphere Program and the ANU Climate Change Institute. Steffen is author of more than 100 scientific articles and papers. From Canberra, Australia, Will Steffen, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex.
Well, in your home country, you had epic wildfires this year, and I see more record-hot temperatures there in November, which is technically still your spring. How is it looking for heat and fire this summer in Australia?
Fortunately, not quite as bad as last summer, but we're still surprised about how bad the heat has been. We're in a so-called La Niña phase of ENSO, which for us down here usually means cooler and wetter conditions. But despite that, as you know, we've had record hot conditions. We've had some fires break out. There was a fire in Western Sydney just a day or two ago. Hopefully it won't be as bad as last year, but we've got our fingers crossed on that one.
Well, you know, when I spoke to Kevin Trenberth recently, he said that he thinks that global warming now from humans has overcome things like La Niña and El Niño, and so that we will still see a warming signal even when it should be cooling, as you say.
Yeah, and that's exactly what we're seeing here now, is that the warming from greenhouse gases emitted by humans is now, I think, well over 1 degree. And that's really swamping the couple tenths of a degree up or down when you get a La Niña or an El Niño. So he's right. We're just now being overwhelmed by the longer-term trend of climate change.
If Australia's become the fire zone in some years, other countries are becoming storm zones. In 2020, the Philippines and Vietnam were hit by multiple super typhoons. Nicaragua and Louisiana were struck by huge hurricanes several times. And many of those places will take years to recover, but before they can, the next big storms will hit them again. How long until a society cannot recover?
I think that depends on a couple of things. One, of course, is the increasing incidence and intensity of these extreme weather events. But the other one, which is very important, is the vulnerability of the society itself. Because when we look back in history, going back through hundreds of thousands of years, we can actually see societies which have collapsed, but others which have made it through under the same stress. So a really important area of research, in addition, obviously, to climate change, is how resilient are societies, what makes a society resilient, and so on. There's actually a very good example from the present-day United States, and that goes back, I think, four or 500 years, maybe even a bit more than that, with Native Americans down in the southwest of the U.S. And there were three different societies relatively close together, and there was an exceedingly long dry period. Two of the societies collapsed, but the other one came through largely unchanged. So it's an interesting lesson that we really need now to look carefully at how resilient our societies are, where the vulnerabilities are, because we are facing situations, and we will in the coming decades, where the most vulnerable countries, I think, will be really at the risk of collapse as they get clobbered, as you said, by these multiple events, more intense events, and so on.
Well, and it's interesting because even rich countries don't seem to be able to stop some of these impacts. We look at Venice, where over two decades and billions of dollars they built a defense system against rising seas that were swamping the classic city, and they tried it this year, and it didn't work. It didn't stop the flooding of downtown Venice. So what if we can't stop continuing climate damage?
Well, I think what we're going to have to do is learn how to somehow adapt to it. But if we don't, if we try to deny it, or if we misspend the money in terms of adaptation and so on, we could get to situations where we're simply overwhelmed, not just physically in terms of flooding, in terms of coastal erosion and so on, but also economically as much of our infrastructure gets damaged. We've done some estimates down here in Australia of the cost of coastal inundation, coastal flooding and so on, because much of our infrastructure in cities actually lie on the coastline. And there are pretty horrific projections of how much our economy is going to be damaged later this century. And, of course, once you start looking at very large numbers or percentages of GDP that are going to be hit, that's sort of telling you that you could face a situation where the economy unravels and your society does have trouble, real trouble, dealing with just the general aspects of life.
Well, I want to dig deeper into this conversation, but first I just want to check back with you about an interview we had in 2018, and it was about one of the landmark papers in climate science, I think, Trajectories of the Earth System in the Anthropocene. And my simplistic impression from that is there is a kind of shelf of warming, sort of stabilized Earth, as you call it, that's possible. And then there's a kind of drop-off cliff going to hothouse Earth, and that might not be survivable. Did I get that right? And where do you think we are in that progression now?
Yeah, I think you did get that right. And where we are now, I think, is we're looking at the Paris targets and can we meet them? I think there's extremely strong evidence now that we're not going to meet the lower target, 1.5. There's just too much already locked in, too much warming already locked into the system, plus the fact that we can't get emissions down fast enough to meet that one. So the best we can do is meeting the upper target of below 2 degrees or around 2 degrees. That would be stabilized Earth, I think, in our 2018 paper. And we don't want to underplay, though, the fact that that would still require some fairly significant adaptation measures. There would be still high risks. And some of the most vulnerable countries, perhaps in South Asia or Africa, could struggle to survive even a 2-degree temperature rise. So stabilized Earth may not lead to large-scale collapse, but it certainly would be damaging and difficult to survive. But if we start triggering these feedbacks, and we published a paper a year later in 2019 analyzing where we were with some of those feedbacks that indeed led to the cliff in the hothouse Earth paper, and we see that some of them are already showing signs of instability. Obviously, Arctic sea ice is melting, and it appears to be melting at an increasing rate. The same is true for the Greenland ice sheet. That is melting primarily from the surface of the ice sheet, and that appears to be accelerating. We're seeing more instabilities in the permafrost in Siberia, and we're seeing increasing droughts in the Amazon basin, along with, of course, the direct human pressures of increasing deforestation. So when you add all this up, that's telling you that the Earth system itself is becoming increasingly unstable. We don't think we've crossed that planetary tipping point yet, and we don't think we will if we stay within 1.5. But once you start going above 1.5, I think the risk that these tipping points could really take off, that risk rises. And that's the one that causes the really high-level risk, not just to the most vulnerable countries, but to many parts of human civilization.
Well, I have interviewed hundreds of scientists about the severe risks from climate change, and until very recently, I'd say 99% of them attempted a positive note at the end, encouraging us to take steps to avoid climate disaster, things we should do. And only Utah atmosphere scientist Tim Garrett said a collapse of this system was inevitable, and he said civilization needs to stop anyway to save a habitable planet. Now, you and these other prominent scientists and experts say it is time to talk about societal collapse. What do you mean by that term? What are you envisioning?
Well, societal collapse means an uncontrollable decline in many aspects of a society. So when you look at past collapses, some of them can be slow and drawn out. Some of them can be very much more rapid. But a contemporary example of at least a partial collapse was what happened to the Soviet Union after it disappeared in, I think, around 1989 or 1990. And how would you define that collapse? Well, the economy went down, GDP went down quite strongly, life expectancy for a while went down as well. There were food shortages and things like that. So that was a partial collapse. I remember going into the old Soviet Union, into Russia, just 3 or 4 years after that, after the Soviet Union collapsed, and with my Russian colleagues having trouble just to find enough food to take out and do some research out in Siberia. Also, it was very lawless. I witnessed a murder in a restaurant in Siberia, just as part of the everyday life there. When we went out there, we didn't know who was in control. It was either the KGB or the mafia. And if you got it wrong, your life was in danger. So there are a lot of examples there of what at least a partial collapse looks like. Fortunately, Russia has pulled out of that. But I think that period shows that even large, powerful countries are not immune to at least partial collapse. So again, I define collapse, and a lot of people who actually study this, as an uncontrollable decline in a society. It doesn't mean it's going to disappear, but it means that the economy is difficult. There's oftentimes health goes down, life expectancy goes down, and so on. So that's the sort of thing you look at. And obviously, the most vulnerable countries would be the poorer ones in South Asia, for example, and some in Africa. And the combination of the fact that they're already under stress simply from poor governance, very poor conditions, poor health. And then when you put climate change on top of that, those would be the first examples of countries that simply couldn't cope and would start unraveling and collapsing.
I'm not so sure it's just in the Global South. I mean, a lot of the things you just described, sad as it is, might be said about the United States today during this pandemic. And why bring this warning out now during a terrible pandemic, Will?
Yeah, look, I think it's just time for us to consider the high-end risks of climate change. It really doesn't have anything to do with the pandemic. If there was no pandemic on, I think we would still put out the same sorts of warnings. But I think a lot of us are concerned that, I think as you noted, we've been calling for action for a long time. A lot of people have been positive, hopeful, saying we can still do this and so on. But yet emissions keep climbing, temperature keeps rising, extreme weather events get worse, and nothing really substantive really happens at the global level. We're definitely not on track to meet the Paris targets. It's 5 years after the Paris Climate Accord was signed, and still no signs that we're even coming close to doing what's required. So I think, and then also I should say, I think there's been a real reticence to discuss the high-end risks as if this will be too frightening for people and so on. But I think it's time we actually have to understand that if the climate system really gets out of control, we are indeed facing some high-end risks. We need to talk about them, consider them, and hopefully use this information in making better decisions.
Yes, various experts say, well, look, the media, and I've even had this in email, you shouldn't cover too much bad news because it puts people in a state of depression and then they feel powerless to act and they won't do anything. But I don't know. It seems like it is time to start talking about collapse in public.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that the psychology is interesting there that you talk about. I'm not an expert on psychology, but I certainly don't view it in that way. When I see a really serious threat, I want to know exactly what that threat looks like, how serious it is, whether the risks involved, and what we can do to minimize those risks or avoid the catastrophe. I guess it comes a little bit from when I was younger. One of my main hobby was climbing and mountaineering. And when you go up in high mountains, Alpine mountains or the Himalaya, you absolutely have to understand the existential risks that you face from avalanches, ice cliffs, weather shifts, and so on. You don't want to just get good news and say, don't tell me about those because it's frightening. Well, it is frightening, but you have to face that if you're going to climb the mountain, and you have to take steps to minimize the risk. So I think we need to sort of psychologically grow up and say, look, we have to look at these risks. It's important for our children and grandchildren that we actually do look at them soberly, get the best information we can, and then take action to minimize these risks. It seems pretty obvious to me that that's the way to go forward.
So even when we know climate change is coming and it's going to be dangerous, can we really make a plan to survive the breakdown of society? I mean, isn't the point being that society breaks down and things don't work anymore?
Yeah, I think the point is we need to do everything we can to avoid that sort of scenario. And there's a lot of people are now saying time is running out rapidly to avoid that. And this is really, in a way, the fork in the road that we envisaged in that 2018 paper on Earth system trajectories, that the fork in that pathway between stabilized Earth and hothouse Earth probably lies this decade, maybe in the first half of the decade. Certainly, I think by 2030, we will have put ourselves on one of the other pathways, and it'll be difficult to shift. That's why it's extremely important now that people understand the seriousness of this risk and understand that the students are right. This is an emergency situation, and we actually do have to make the right choices over the next couple of years.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Professor Will Steffen from Australian National University. He's part of a large group that just published a warning on climate and the risk of societal collapse. How are we going to raise this, Will, in our community?
I think efforts like you're doing there, talking about it, I think people need to write opinion pieces on it. We need to get on the news media and talk about what these high-end risks look like and be very careful and ensure that we say, how do we avoid these risks as best we can, and impress upon people that we simply can't wait anymore. We actually do have to take meaningful and vigorous action on climate change now. But the important thing is there's lots of communication channels out there in this digital world that we can use to start talking about these issues. I think the important thing is we simply have to talk about them. We can't avoid them anymore. We have to really make ourselves aware of what the high-end risks of climate change actually look like.
All right, you're hired. You can be a Radio EcoShock host.
No, you do that very well, Alex. I'm just saying we need to have a few more people outlets and people out there like you.
I just want to make a mention of a couple of other signatories on this warning letter. Ye Tao was on Radio EcoShock a few weeks ago, and he was developing a very sophisticated equipment piece when he realized his invention might never be used because of climate-driven breakdown. And so now he's working on reflective mirrors to help our energy imbalance. Another signatory, Professor Alan Jones, caught my eye. He led a study using the DAW Global Food Security Model. That showed civilization will collapse by 2040 due to catastrophic food shortages. So his paper was Global Food Security and Food Riots, an agent-based modeling approach. So I'm wondering, Will, how do you think scientific research and public policy should change to account for possible breakdowns in the Anthropocene?
You know, I think we've got a couple of challenges there. One is the fact that our present governance systems don't like to look at those sort of scenarios, and I think partly that's because of most governments around the world are either explicitly or implicitly support a neoliberal economic system, which argues for continued growth as if the planet is infinite and can keep supporting that. The second thing I think is the time scale is that most governments are operating on shorter time scales. They're operating on election cycles and so on. Of 3 or 4 years, and that's why a projection of food riots and collapse to 2040 may not excite them too much, because in their perspective, 2040 is a long way away. And that, by the way, is why I don't get too excited about all countries now saying we'll achieve net zero emissions by 2050. 2050 is a long way off. It's actually very short in terms of the stuff I do, but in terms of politics, that's a long way off. So a lot of those pledges, I suspect, are somewhat empty. So I think those two things really are causing us to struggle to deal with these existential threats like collapse of the global food system and so on. We simply have to work out how we get these sorts of analyses out on the table and have ways we can actually discuss them openly and honestly.
Will Steffen, what do you think about geoengineering, such as proposals to block out some of the energy from the sun?
Yeah, I think those are extremely dangerous technologies. They're a bit persuasive in a simple way, in that, well, if we have an energy imbalance, let's just block off some of the incoming energy. But we don't know enough about the complex behavior of the Earth system as a whole to understand what the side effects might be. So depending on what's used to block out some of the incoming sunlight, that may affect, obviously will affect atmospheric circulation, which will affect the precipitation patterns, which means that one country may have its rainfall stolen by another country that's putting up aerosols into the atmosphere, for example. And another thing, if that's all we do and keep pouring CO2 in the atmosphere, that's going to continue to acidify the ocean and eventually really degrade the marine biosphere. Third thing I will say is that the Earth is a complex system. This is a very, very simple cause-effect logic used behind solar radiation management. We still do not have any models or any good understanding to really project what might happen to the Earth system as a whole, what discontinuities, what tipping points, what shocks might occur if we actually change the incoming, the distribution and amount of incoming sunlight. So I think it's an extremely, extremely risky technology.
But We know that we are heading towards desperate times, possibly as soon as 2030. It seems likely to me that somebody's going to try it.
You may be right on that, and then we'll certainly find out then what's going to happen. But the cure may be as bad as the disease is the problem there.
On December 9th, the United Nations released their new emissions gap report, and they say despite a reduction in fossil emissions during the pandemic, well, as the New York Times puts it, the biggest polluters are continuing to pollute. So what kind of conversation do we require to overcome it, even when we see this train heading straight for us?
Yeah, I think one of the things we need to do in such a conversation is really to talk more fundamentally about our present socioeconomic system. Because basically, I look at it this way. It's much more complex than this, but just to simplify it, one approach to dealing with this problem is to basically maintain the present system that we've got, but change the technologies to non-carbon polluting technologies. Classic one here is renewable energy instead of fossil fuels and so on, but continue basically in the same direction that we're going. The other one is a much more fundamental shift. It's a fundamental shift in values, lifestyles, and so on, where, in fact, we actually consume much less. Economies shrink and then stabilize rather than grow. And we live very different lifestyles, ones that not only don't pollute the atmosphere with carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, but also treat the biosphere in a much more holistic stewardship-type approach rather than as a resource to be exploited. So I think those two human paths that we could take, those are the sort of discussions we actually need to have on which direction we want to take.
You know, I was going to ask you whether we should have these scary conversations with kids, but then when I think about it, really the kids are already shouting at us about this stuff.
Absolutely. You can just look at Greta Thunberg, the Swedish, young Swedish girl who started the student strikes and so on. She doesn't mince words about what the possible risks are to her generation. So they're actually ahead of us, I think, in saying, look, you're going to really destroy my future if you keep going the way you're going. So those are some pretty powerful concepts and words that they use. They're ahead of us in thinking of worst-case scenarios and their future. So I think we should pay a lot more attention to what they're telling us older people.
In 2020, we see that superstorms or fires or drought hit different countries at different times. Maybe we should be thinking in terms of collapses, plural, rather than one grand end to civilization, as so many sci-fi novelists see it. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I've always envisaged so-called collapse as something that we've seen in the past in human societies. And it isn't one grand everything falls over sort of scenario. It's normally the most vulnerable parts of a society or the most vulnerable countries start struggling and then hit their own collapse in terms of uncontrollable decline in terms of living standards. Oftentimes, access to food, conflict is also part of it. But these can spread. And one of the concerns is that in a highly globalized world where the economic system is increasingly globalized, you can get a contagion effect where when some of the most vulnerable countries start to collapse, that reverberates through the system and generates downturns and collapses elsewhere in the global system. And then, of course, there may be a point, a global tipping point, where that becomes uncontrollable, even to wealthy, fairly resilient countries. This is extremely hard to predict. No, I don't think anyone can actually predict this, but it is not an illogic or impossible scenario.
Some long-planned scientific expeditions did not go out this year due to the pandemic, but now, as we're talking, I'm wondering whether some signs of collapse or severe economic troubles may damage scientific experts and efforts to study and predict as we go along. Do you see problems coming down that way?
Yeah, I haven't thought too much about that because I think the real concern is not really whether scientific research and efforts can continue, but with the general public and population and the suffering that they will feel as there are collapses and downturns around the world driven by climate change, interacting with obviously some local vulnerabilities and so on. So I think obviously we struggle in the scientific community to try to build up the scientific community in the developing parts of the world. When I worked internationally, it was always a struggle to get on committees and so on to get scientists from Africa, Asia, and to some extent South America. So already we have a large imbalance in where most of the science is done and where the expertise is done. And if those vulnerable countries start collapsing, then we're going to have problems, even bigger problems, working with scientists in those countries. Good example was the Soviet Union when it collapsed. I remember going out in Siberia to really what was quite a good forest research institute in the middle of Siberia. But the scientists were out pumping petrol and taking any menial job they can get because their jobs were completely eliminated because there was no money to pay them. So this is the sort of thing that you might see in the science community as you see collapses in some parts of the world.
We have to hope we can keep our satellite systems going.
Yes, that's true. That's an interesting one, too, because already we're seeing a gap in some of the satellites that go over the far north and that have altimeters on them. They can measure to a very high level of accuracy what's happening on Greenland and so on. But there were some budget cuts. Some of those satellites, their lifetime is ending and the replacements haven't been approved yet. So we're going to get a gap already, even in wealthy countries, in some of the data that we need to monitor what's happening at the poles. So that's a very likely scenario, is that scientific infrastructure and personnel may suffer as national budgets shrink or are hit by other needs.
And we're heading into some difficult decades, and I worry for my poor listeners who hear you and I, and they agree, and they're learning about climate science, and they believe that this is very, very serious. But then they still have to get in a gas-powered car and go to work at a job that may not help the climate at all, but they've got to put food on the table. So it's so hard to bring those two personalities, those two minds together and be coherent.
Yeah, that's right. And I think what that example you gave really does point to the heart of the problem. Is that this is a very deeply systemic problem, and individuals aren't going to solve it on their own. We can do what we can to reduce our own impact on the environment, our own emissions, but ultimately we have to change the system to get this underway. So it's really important that we take collective action, that we get together, force change in our political systems, our economic systems, and so on. And that's the only way we're eventually going to deal effectively with this problem.
What are you working on these days?
I'm still working mainly on the follow-ons from that 2018 paper. So I'm working on tipping points, tipping cascades, that sort of thing, to try to understand how far we can push the Earth system before it really starts to destabilize. So one of the ways we try to develop a guidance system for avoiding that is the so-called planetary boundaries approach, which tries to define what the state of the Earth system is and how far we can push it before we really get the risk of these tipping cascades. And we're just in the process now of doing the third major update of those planetary boundaries, so I'm spending a lot of time working on that as well.
From Canberra, Australia, we've been speaking with Professor Will Steffen, one of the larger figures in the international science community, in my opinion. And the Guardian letter warning about climate collapse was published December 6, 2020. You can find links to that and to all the science we've talked about in my weekly show blog published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Will, thank you so much for spending valuable time with us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.